Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is writer-director Quentin Tarantino's 9th film. It stars Leonardo DiCaprio as a fading Western actor named Rick Dalton, and Brad Pitt as his loyal stuntman Cliff Booth.
It's set in the changing Hollywood of 1969, and in many ways it's a breezy romp through studio backlots and makeup trailers, but hanging over every frame is the threat of violence in the form of a very real historical tragedy, the brutal Manson family murders in the Hollywood Hills. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Glenn Weldon. Glossy LA nostalgia laced with grisly violence. It's peak Tarantino, but does it work? That's what we're going to wrestle with on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR, so don't go away.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Neon, presenting Loose, a psychological thriller hailed by First Showing as the most provocative film of the 2019 Sundance Film Festival, and which the film stage calls a major work of contemporary cinema. Featuring acclaimed performances from Oscar winner Octavia Spencer, Naomi Watts, Tim Roth, and Kelvin Harrison Jr., Loose opens in New York and L.A. this Friday. Additional markets throughout August.
Welcome back. You just met NPR Music's Stephen Thompson. Also with us is writer Chris Klimek. Hey, Chris.
Howdy, Glenn.
And joining us from New York is Monica Castillo, features editor for the film website Cherry Picks. Welcome back, Monica.
Thank you.
All right. So in the top, we just mentioned the Manson family murders. We did that because the film concerns them in a weird way. In the movie, Leonardo DiCaprio's character Rick lives next door to Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate, who is played by Margot Robbie. And the real Sharon Tate was killed by the Manson family in 1969. And a lot of this film is just soaking in that 1969 Hollywood vibe. But it is kind of strangely unhurried for a Quentin Tarantino film. Would you agree, Stephen?
Yeah, it's about 2 hours and 40 minutes long, and virtually every frame of this movie contains something that Quentin Tarantino loves. And that's what I like most about it. It could be restagings of old cowboy shows on TV. It could be Leonardo DiCaprio's squeaky leather jacket.
Yeah.
A lot of like the mechanics and sounds of cigarettes. Cigarettes are to this movie what the N-word was to Jackie Brown.
Right.
Which is to say plentiful.
Mm-hmm.
Old dog food labels. Women's feet.
Yeah, there you
go. There's a lot of affection in this movie, and it's a medley of Quentin Tarantino's greatest hits in terms of the things that he loves. Now, your mileage may vary. If you have frustrations with some of the ways that Quentin Tarantino depicts women, this movie will frustrate you, as at times it frustrated me. Overall, though, I was overwhelmed by just the sheer joy that was clearly put into it. There's a love in this movie, and like The Hateful Eight was a movie that really didn't work for me, in part because it was so acrid.
Right.
And this movie, by comparison, is so loving and buoyed by a bunch of really wonderful performances, which we'll get to later.
Yeah. Monica, what'd you think?
Strangely, I guess more on the favorable side. I really enjoyed
it.
Oh, okay. I wasn't quite sure about that. But I really like got a sense of that love. And yeah, I also left The Hateful Eight with this kind of drained feeling. Like, it just felt so cynical and angry. And then this one, you can tell, like, he has an affection for this place. He has an affection for this time. He has affection for these characters. There are references within references within the reference, referencing something else. Like, I just had so much fun with that. I watched it again a second time last night and was discovering more references.
Mm-hmm.
So for movie lovers, it really feels like, and even just like pop culture fans, because there's also a lot of television and radio going on.
Yeah.
It really feels like a treat.
Right, right. Chris, I mean, you ranked this pretty high on your list.
Yeah. Right now I've got it at number three on my Tarantino oeuvre after two viewings. Yeah, it's just that this is a really fun, as Stephen said, buoyant movie that propels you along. Yeah, this really is like the way that watching Avengers Endgame for a Marvel zombie, you know, all the things that are planted and stuff. This is like that, except for pop cultural obsessives. And it is something new for Tarantino that these are people who are just living in this time and place, rather than people who live in some bizarre, you know, fantasy present of like the Los Angeles of Pulp Fiction or something,
right,
where places like Jackrabbit Slims exist. But for some reason, they're still talking about 60s and 70s movies and TV shows. And, you know, so it's a little bit less fantastical in that way, that this is set within showbiz, so it makes sense for them to be talking about it. But I really loved it. I loved the relationship between Cliff and Rick.
Mm-hmm.
this is a movie that also really, really trades on star power in a way that it's been a while since we've seen something. And to see these two megawatt stars believably portraying this warm friendship and this one wherein there is a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And Cliff, the Brad Pitt character, seems to be perfectly comfortable being subservient to Rick, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. That was a surprise, too. I really love this film.
In terms of what those two actors are giving you, Leo DiCaprio is doing more. I often think he's kind of a mannered actor, but I really loved him here because he was projecting anxiety and alcoholism in out of his pores. And Brad Pitt, who, you know, early on in his career, he had this kind of reputation for being a laconic cowboy guy.
Right.
And now he's just sort of steering into that skid in a major way. But let's talk about some of the stuff that Tarantino loves. The character of Sharon Tate is played here by Margot Robbie, and she is not given much to do except to look luminous. This film considers her an object, not a character.
Right.
Although she does get this one very lovely moment where she gets to go into a theater and watch herself on screen. And I think the film wants you to think that that's deepening her in some way.
Well, I thought it did, but that does kind of give us the language of this movie overall, because when we're watching Margot Robbie as Sharon Tate watching herself on screen in the Bruin Theater in The Wrecking Crew, the Matt Helm movie, we're watching, like, when we see the clips, that's the real Sharon Tate. Like,
right.
They didn't digitally paint Margot Robbie into those scenes or anything. You know, and like, they don't look exactly alike. It's enough of a match. But, that's another theatrical thing that I was perfectly happy to go with. I do think that'll probably be the most divisive element of this film. Mm-hmm. It already is, that Robbie doesn't have a lot of dialogue. She doesn't have that much screen time. The best defense of this that I've heard still is not great, that it sort of posits Sharon Tate as this sort of angelic presence, watching over the movie.
Yeah.
I'm going to say ew to that. I have heard that character described as representing normalcy, and that clearly Quentin Tarantino views the real life Sharon Tate murders as a pivot point, a kind of loss of innocence of Hollywood, and that that character represents the innocence of that time. I've seen that explanation. I think he is more comfortable building out these male characters than he is with any of the female characters in this film.
So my article actually on Cherry Picks kind of delves into that character, because it was already, like, before the movie even came out, people were talking about, well, she doesn't have a lot of lines. That started at Cannes at the premiere. And there was a sort of kerfuffle around it. So for me, she kind of represents a symbol, both of that celebrity status. I wouldn't say it goes so far as to, like, paint her as, like, the symbol of innocence.
Yeah.
That is a variation of that argument. I just think about, you know, you could put almost any of the other victims of the Manson murders in that kind of role, and you can depict them in that way. She is just living life. She's packing for a trip. She's hanging out with friends. She's listening to records. She goes out to dinner. I mean, if anything, it's kind of demythologizing her in a way that I haven't really seen before in a number of the other adaptations of the story.
Mm-hmm. Now, the way this film works with history, it exists, I'm going to say it, in a liminal space between between history and fantasy. Because, of course, it's set in Hollywood, right? And it starts to clue you in on what it's doing right away when we see shots from his TV Western or a commercial.
Yes.
Because there are camera moves and there's a quality of light that just didn't exist back then. Instead of just doing, like, standard over-the-shoulder like they would do on TV back then, it's basically if Tarantino went back in time and made TV Westerns. What I liked about the film is how it clues you in on that right away, and it also is winking at you constantly with these cameos, all of these cameos. Did you guys have any favorites?
Oh my goodness, there's so many.
I don't know.
Let's talk.
I'm always worried about spoiling with
right.
cameos.
Well,
right.
I mean, okay, he's in the trailer. So, Timothy Olyphant has a little bit as Jim Stacy, real actor, star of Lancer, real show. That's the pilot that Rick is brought in to play the heavy, the bad guy of their pilot. And that's the show that we see them on the set, where there's a really long take, and you know, where you get some of that more elaborate camera work that would not have been possible in television of the time.
It's interesting. We're talking about cameos here, but I don't even necessarily think of it as like a series of cameos so much as he deploys these character actors for one scene, maybe two scenes, and then kind of goes on, like allows them to shine. Like they're just one more thing that he loves that he's putting on screen, and then he moves on. So you have a string of what in a lot of movies could seem like stunt casting, but here just feels like he's just emptying out his toolbox, and his toolbox includes access to these stars that he loves, some of whom have been in his movies before, some of whom he's introducing, this child actor, Julia Butters, who
amazing.
But you just have this string of faces, many of whom are familiar, some of whom aren't, that he's just giving you little bits of in ways that feels joyful.
Right. Now, Monica, this film, to me, looked like 1969, didn't necessarily feel like 1969. There's not a lot of political... It's a very closed bubble, this Hollywood that he is positing.
Yeah.
I think he got the look and the sounds, as we were talking about that pleather jacket making those squeaks, in terms of something deeper about the history of the time, the unrest, the Vietnam, anything you want to mention. It didn't really touch on that. Was that cool with you?
Yeah, actually, it was really cool with me because that speaks to the kind of bubble that Hollywood is.
Right.
I mean, there are just so many people that they don't know what's going on outside of their space. They're not searching out, you know, those what's happening in the news and things like that. They're worried about, you know, their next role, they're rehearsing, whatever it may be. There is that sort of hyper focus on just the industry. And it's also really funny how other actors also know like each other's resumes and like, oh, Rick Dalton, I saw you when I was growing up, or oh, you mean J.K. Hill? You know,
it's
kind of like a shared knowledge. And yeah, it does feel like a reflection of that kind of closeness.
Right, right.
There's a scene where Rick is speaking to one of the Manson gang and he calls him Dennis Hopper as an insult.
Yes.
Hey, Dennis Hopper. That made me laugh.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, can any of you make a compelling argument that Quentin Tarantino, at this point in his career, is still growing as a filmmaker? Or is he just iterating? We've seen this kind of thing from him before.
I would argue that he is. Uh-huh. And I would argue that this feels like tremendous growth from The Hateful Eight, which is so technically beautifully made.
Right.
And to me, felt rotten at its core. To me, this film almost inverts that and has an enormous amount of love and affection, not only for the place and not only for things, but for a lot of these characters in a way that I found very, very refreshing. And it did feel to me a little bit more like Quentin Tarantino has said that this movie is his Roma, you know, this affectionate recreation of beloved scenes from his childhood. And the love and warmth that exudes from the film Roma, I feel like some of that DNA is here too. I responded really warmly just to the amount of affection, and it's affection that is deployed with that maximum skill and craft that you see in his other films.
Right.
So it did feel like growth to me.
Yeah.
Again, I love that scene with Sharon Tate, watching Margot Robbie playing Sharon Tate, watching actual Sharon Tate on the screen. Like, that is such a nod and like kind of respectful tribute to her. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I can point to another point in a Tarantino film where he does that and in such a direct way, because there's references and, you know, someone dropping some kind of, you know, a name there or a thing, another pop culture item here, but it's not the same. This was very much like, this is who he's crediting, and then this is his way to bring her kind of back to a lot of people. I mean, I'm actually kind of impressed with how many people have never quite heard this story or don't know the finer details in the way that some of us, you know, have, because we've seen movies, we've, you know, listened to Karina Longworth, You Must Remember This season on Charles Manson, books, all kinds of different things that have been produced out of this story. And yet, you know, now he's kind of bringing it and piquing other people's interest, but maybe not just in the murders, but in actual her life and her work.
I do think this movie begs to be watched twice.
Yeah.
And I think it rewards. I have not yet seen it a second time, but I would be willing to. And that is high praise.
Yeah. I was going to say 2 hours and 45 minutes. That's high praise from Stephen Thompson. Are we going to be talking about this film come Oscar time?
Yes.
Is this kind of film?
100%. Yes.
It's not too pulpy. It's not too genre. It's not too. It's about Hollywood. So
yes, about Hollywood. It is not only is it about Hollywood. It is a deeply lovingly rendered film about Hollywood. Mm. The Oscars are going to eat this movie up with a spoon, and I think they should. I think that Leonardo DiCaprio performance at the center of this film. I liked it so much better than his performance in The Revenant, which
Same.
Won an Oscar.
Agreed, agreed. Yeah.
I think it is such a. I mean, you said mannered, but it is so nuanced and layered, and there's just so much acting going on in every yeah. frame within it.
Yes.
And I mean that not in a bad way.
Right.
And I just think so much of the set design, the costuming, the sound, the music, oh my God, the Oscars love a movie that loves Hollywood,
yes.
and this
yeah.
movie loves Hollywood.
I feel like every actor who has spent the last 10 years being zipped into superhero costumes is going to go to this movie and be like, oh man, I was born in the wrong time.
Okay, this film is still kind of trickling into theaters. Not everybody has seen it, and we want to hear from you when you do. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow Chris at CT Klimek and Monica at M. Casti Movies. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. And if you have a second and you're so inclined, please subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And we will see you all on Friday.
It has already been an eventful summer in politics.
Yeah, between the 2020 debates and the president's battle over immigration, there's a lot going on.
And when there's news you need to know about, the NPR Politics podcast is there to tell you what happened.
Not to mention, we're hitting the road so you can meet all of the 2020 contenders.
Oh, NPR is going to drive me completely crazy.
The NPR Politics podcast.
Subscribe!